We're going to continue looking, as we have the past couple of weeks, at some of the basic text and beliefs of premillennialism. We talked some this morning about the kingdom of Christ, what kind of kingdom he came to set up, when was that kingdom started, and then what did the kingdom have to do with the church? Was the church simply an afterthought, or had God planned it from the very beginning? As you recall from this morning, I ask you to look at, if you had time, Matthew chapter 24, as we're going to begin looking at that very critical chapter this evening, and then also look at it Wednesday evening for a while. Matthew chapter 24. But whenever we study God's Word or any book or writing, context is the most critical thing. And what do I mean by context? Well, two things primarily. Number one, I mean, what has the writer been talking about just prior to the material you're studying? And number two, what else does the entire work have to do with the topic that you're studying? So when we look at Matthew chapter 24, we want to look at what is happening just prior to these chapters. Well, when you go back just a few chapters, on the Monday before Jesus was crucified on Friday, we find him entering Jerusalem. And of course, one of the first things he does is he cleanses the temple in Matthew chapter 21. Right after he cleanses the temple, then he begins delivering a series of parables describing the destruction of the Jewish nation and the destruction of the temple. In Matthew chapter 22 and in Matthew chapter 23, the parable of the wicked vine dressers and in the parable of the wedding feast. Both of those describe what the result will be to the Jewish people when they reject Christ. Jesus knew he was going to be rejected. And so he delivers these parables, those two in particular, so that the Jewish people would know what would happen to them as a result of them rejecting Christ. So their rejection of Jesus was in no way a surprise to Jesus or God the Father, as some teach. Jesus knew when he came into the world what was going to happen to him, so did the Father. They knew the Jews were going to reject him. And so when Jesus delivers these two parables in Matthew 22 and Matthew 23, he makes sure that the Jews will know what their future is all about. So, Matthew 21, Matthew 22, and in Matthew 23, he describes to the Jews their future. In Matthew 23, of course, we have the account of his very severe denunciation of the leaders of the Jews, the scribes and the Pharisees. And we have from the very beginning of that chapter, pretty much all the way through Matthew 23, his description of why the scribes and Pharisees were so wicked. And of course, it primarily had to do with their hypocrisy. And he goes over that and over that and over that in Matthew 23. And so that's what's happening right before the account of Matthew chapter 24. He has talked about, he's cleansed the temple, and of course that made him very angry, you recall. Remember, he cleansed the temple at least twice, once early in his ministry and once late in his ministry. And both times he became angry, but certainly in Matthew 21 he's very angry at what his people, the Jewish people, had done to the house of God. At the end of this, he talks about how the house of God was no longer the house of God, but it was their house. See, it wasn't even God's house anymore. They had so defiled it by their actions and their attitudes that it was no longer God's house. It was just their house. He said, "Your house is left to you desolate." And of course, after then talking all about that, that leads to the great lamentation that he makes as he looks over the city of Jerusalem. Let's look at that in Matthew chapter 23, verse 37. These are the last verses right before Matthew 24. Jesus is talking. He says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Of course, we know right before that, he denounces the scribes and Pharisees for killing the prophets that had been sent to them. And he said, all of this has been stored up for you. And notice what he says in verse 36. He says, "Assuredly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." He's getting ready to talk about what's going to happen to the Jewish nation in that generation. He was denouncing them for their hypocrisy, for them rejecting the prophets, for them rejecting Him. That's the context of Matthew chapter 24. And so now, let's look at Matthew chapter 24. He begins, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and His disciples came up to show Him the buildings of the temple." Of course, Mark and Luke also record this very same thing. And in Mark and Luke's account, they emphasize, Mark and Luke do, how the apostles were glorying in the temple. It's like they were taking Jesus by and saying, "Look how magnificent this temple is." And it was magnificent. This was the second temple, the one that was built, of course, with Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah in those days. And of course, Herod had added to it and made it a monstrous place during Herod's time. He had put massive plates of gold around it, so when you looked at it from afar, it was just like the sun. It was so bright. And so it was a magnificent building. And for these apostles, these disciples, they were very proud of it. They were glorying in this building. Now Jesus says, verse 2, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." This just absolutely astonished the disciples. For one reason, some of the blocks, the stones that were made up of the temple, were as big as a boxcar and weighed many tons. So they couldn't imagine anything powerful enough to knock these stones down. And then he says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" He had just said, this magnificent temple, all the stones are going to be knocked down. Now, us today, we should be able to see very easily that he is not talking about the end of the world. What's going to happen to the stones at the end of the world? 2 Peter chapter 3, verses like 9 through 12, says that they're all going to be destroyed, burned up. There will not be one stone left upon another. There won't be any stones. There won't be any stones thrown down. There won't be anything. It's all going to be destroyed. So at the very beginning of this, we have an indication Jesus is not in any way talking about the end of the world. The disciples thought he was, and millions of people today thought he was talking about the end of the world. But he gives an indication at the very beginning he is not talking about the end of the world. Because there's going to be stones thrown down upon one another and left there. 2 Peter said, that's not the end of the world. So these apostles, his followers, are asking, when are these things going to be that the temple's going, all the stones are going to be thrown down? And then they say, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now the disciples probably thought they were asking one question, because these disciples, of course, were all Jewish people. They were they knew the Jewish religion, been raised in the Jewish religion. So to them, they couldn't possibly imagine a time when the temple would be destroyed and yet things would go on as normal. They couldn't imagine that. So to them, all of this would be happening at the same time. The temple would be destroyed, Jesus would come again, the world would be over. So they thought they were basically asking one question. But of course, Jesus knew better. Jesus knew those were two separate things. two very entirely separate things. And that, of course, is where the world makes the biggest mistake in Matthew chapter 24. They assume the entire chapter is talking about Jesus' second coming at the end of the world. And, of course, some of them believe that there will be a special thousand-year reign thrown in also. That's the biggest mistake. Usually, when we have in the Bible some... A lot of this is apocalyptic, especially as we get later in the chapter. Very symbolic and figurative. Usually there is a key verse that helps us interpret it. And that key verse in Matthew chapter 24, and we should go ahead and read it, I suppose, now. That particular verse is verse 34. Matthew chapter 24, verse 34. Jesus talks about all these signs and all these things that's going to happen. And then in verse 34 he says, "Surely I say to you, this generation will," what? "By no means pass away till all these things take place." That's the key verse. He says, everything I've talked about all the way down to verse 34 will take place in that generation. In that generation. So everything we're going to talk about in the next few verses took place in the first century, every last one of them. That's the key verse in Matthew 24. And Jesus made it so plain that the disciples couldn't possibly misunderstand. And it was a good thing they didn't misunderstand, because it saved thousands of lives in the first century by the Christians understanding what Jesus was talking about. Well, let's go on. Verse 4. Again, Jesus is answering two questions. He's first answering the question, when will these things be? The destruction of the temple, the stones falling over and all that. That's the question he answers first. He says, "Take heed that no one deceives you." Was it possible that they would be deceived about these things? Absolutely. So he says, that's why I'm giving you these signs. These things that will take place. So he says, "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So he says, first of all, here are a few things that will begin to take place. That doesn't mean the end is yet. He says, these are just some things that's going to take place. First of all, there's going to be some people who claim that they were the Messiah. False messiahs. And we go back and we record, even in the book of Acts, we have some people who claim to be messiahs. They rose up and they had some followers come after them. That would happen. And those people deceived a lot of others. There'd be wars and rumors of wars. Now, the disciples at this time would be pretty amazed at Jesus saying this, because this was a special time in Roman history. The Roman Empire lasted for a little over 400 years. During this particular time, when Jesus is talking to the apostles, this had a special name historically, and this was a time when there was absolute peace in the Roman Empire. Peace in the Roman Empire. And Jesus says, you're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars? And of course, it wasn't. This was, in the early AD 30s. By AD 40, less than 10 years after Jesus said this, wars started in the Roman Empire. So in less than 10 years after this, war started. And they continued all the way, of course, to the great war that eventually destroyed the city of Jerusalem. But he says, these are going to start to come to pass. But that doesn't mean the end is yet. The end of Jerusalem. That's the question he's answering. So he says, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. And so he mentions again that in the near future, some of these things are going to take place, famines and so forth. We, of course, remember the account in the book of Acts about Agabus, the prophet, who said that there's going to be a great famine. The saints of Jerusalem would be affected. Of course, that takes place some 10 or 15 years or so after Jesus is talking here. And so there would be these things that would begin to happen. But he said that's not the end of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. He says these are the beginning of sorrows. This is the same phrase that's used for sorrows here is the same phrase that's used for a woman who is giving birth. And so he's likening these pains that the people are going to start suffering to the beginning of childbirth, where the pains aren't as severe. He says, this is just the beginning. He says, it's going to get worse. And that's what he compares it to. He says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. And of course, we read in the book of Acts about various ones who were killed, like Stephen, for instance, who were killed for being Christians. That was, of course, wasn't too long after the church was established. So we can read about people to whom this happened. And of course, Jesus knew that would happen, and certainly Stephen would have been in his mind. And we know later, during some of the severe persecutions, that some Christians gave up other Christians, betrayed them. He says, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And of course, we read about those in some of the accounts in the book of Acts, about false prophets, false teachers who would deceive people into believing various things. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And again, as we'll see in a minute, there is no account historically of any Christian dying in the destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Because they believed what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24. That's the reason they were saved. They knew the signs. They knew what was going to happen. And so when they saw those things, they could flee. And so he says, those who endured to the end would be saved. And they were. Because they heeded the signs. They did what Jesus said to do to be able to escape. And they were saved. And he says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. And then the end will come. Not the end of the world, the end of Jerusalem, the end of the Jewish nation, the end of the Jewish people as they were known at that time. The gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Was it? Absolutely. Paul said it was in the book of Colossians. Paul said the gospel had been preached in all the world. And the book of Colossians was, of course, written in the first part of the AD 60s. AD 61, AD 62. So by that time, the gospel had been preached in all the world. And so, when that happened, he says, then the end will come. Now, all the way through verse 14 gives us some events like wars and famines and these type of things that would happen. But he said, those aren't signs in the sense that as soon as you see it, you know the end is right then. He said, no, these things will all take place, but he says, the end isn't yet. Verse 15, critical verse, because it starts with that very important word in the New Testament called therefore. He says, therefore. That's one of those words we always need to look for, because it is a connective word. It connects what he's been talking about to what he's getting ready to talk about. And so he says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now he says, this is the sign. He says, as soon as you see this, you know the destruction is here. This is the real sign. The abomination of desolation. Daniel the prophet talks about it and uses that phrase in three places. I think it's Daniel 7, Daniel 9, and then either Daniel 11 or Daniel 12. That talks about this very thing. We go back historically. The actual siege of Jerusalem by the Roman army started somewhere around 67 or 68 A.D. So that the final end actually started somewhere in that time period. And one of the first things they did when they were able to get into the city was they defiled the temple. And of course, Titus was the one that was leading the Roman army at the time. And of course, he was a Gentile. And so for a Gentile to actually go into the temple was like the worst thing for the Jewish people to ever see. And that's what he did. You think he knew that? Well, sure he knew that. And so Titus does that. So he says, when you see this abomination standing in the holy place, the temple, flee to the mountains. It's in either Mark or Luke's account where he says, when you see the city of Jerusalem surrounded, and of course that's what Titus did, surrounded the city of Jerusalem, and then came into the city and began besieging the city. He says, when that happens, you are in Judea, flee to the mountains. Is he talking about the end of the world? What's going to happen at the end of the world? Are we going to be able to flee to the mountains? Absolutely not. Mountains are going to be destroyed. Won't be any place to flee to. When the end comes, it's going to be like 1 Corinthians 15 talks about, in the twinkling of an eye. Just like that, the end comes. There's not going to be time for anybody to flee to anywhere for any reason. How can people think that's talking about the end of the world and Jesus' second coming? It says, let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Well, if it's the end of the world, why would you want to go back and get your clothes? It's not talking about the end of the world. It has nothing to do with the end of the world. But if you're on the housetop, don't go down. Of course, the housetops in first century Jerusalem were all flat and they were all very close. And this was called the Way of the Roofs. This actually had a name, the Way of the Roofs. And so people could go from one roof to another roof and never get down the street. So save them a bunch of time. Because there'd be tons of people in the street taking up space. The Christians knew that. Jesus had told them almost 40 years before it takes place that when you see the Roman army surrounding Jerusalem, what you want to do is, if you're on the housetop, don't go down. Whatever you have with you, you start fleeing out of the city. Go from housetop to housetop, from rooftop to rooftop, and get out of the city. He says, if you're in the field outside the city of Jerusalem, do not go back into the city to get anything. You stay out of the city. If you're in the field, stay there. He says, but woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Why? Well, it's more difficult. Think about how much harder it would be for you to get out of the city of Jerusalem if you were pregnant or nursing a baby. It would be very difficult. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. Winter, the weather's going to be more difficult, makes travel out of the city more difficult. Sabbath, the city gates would be closed, and so it would be more difficult for you to get out of the city. So he says, pray that none of those things happen to you. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. If you want to read a real horror story, go back and read about the siege of Jerusalem and what the Jewish people went through during that time period. It was absolutely horrible. Over 1 million Jews were killed. And if you can imagine the city of the size of Jerusalem, 1 million people dead in it, I just can't imagine how awful that would be. A lot of them, of course, were taken captive. During the siege, the Roman army, of course, never let any supplies in. So after a time, people got to starving. And of course, there's accounts of cannibalism, people eating one another. There's even one account of a mother eating her baby. That's how bad it got. But that was prophesied by some of the Old Testament prophets, that it would be that bad. The thing we know is, that's going to be the worst tribulation this world's ever seen. So it will never ever be as bad as it was back in the first century at the siege of Jerusalem. I mean, that's a promise from Jesus himself. He says it won't be. And notice something else, this is not the end of the world. Because he says, there will be great tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. He's talking about a future. So time will be after this. So it's not the end of the world. It's not the end of time he's talking about. It can't be. It doesn't fit. He says, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, the Christians, those days will be shortened. And again, we go back, and historically there is no account of any Christians dying in that siege whatsoever. As far as we know, they all made it out. Why? Jesus says it was for the elect's sake. It was for the Christians' sake that it was even shortened from what it could have been. Did it for the church. That if anyone says to you, look here, and the next few verses makes it very clear that he's not talking about him coming, his second coming. He says that if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. So Jesus says, when all these things are happening, don't believe people when they say, well, this is the end of the world, this is Jesus' second coming. Jesus says, don't believe it. And yet millions of people believe it. But Jesus says, don't believe it when people say that that's the end of the world. Jesus says, that's not the end of the world. He says, for false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he's in the inner room, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes in the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Jesus bent over backwards to make sure the people understood that when Jerusalem was getting destroyed, when the Roman armies were coming in and killing the Jews, that was not the end of the world. That was not his second coming. He says, don't believe it. Because he says, when the Son of Man really comes the second time, it's going to be like the lightning from east to west. What does he mean? No one's going to miss it. I mean, you see lightning from one end of the sky to the other. Who sees it? Everybody. So he says, when the Son of Man really comes the second time, it's not going to be in secret, it's not going to be to take away a few people. He says it's going to be something where everybody will see it. For he says, wherever the carcass is, then the eagles will be gathered together. He starts some language that's very similar to what you find, especially in the book of Ezekiel, where he uses similar phrases. What's the carcass here? He seems to be talking about the Jewish nation, the Jewish people. The city of Jerusalem, the temple, the Jewish worship. He says that's the carcass. It's dead. It was dead morally. It's dead spiritually. And the eagles are surrounding it, eating it up. In particular, the Roman army. He says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And he really gets into the figurative language here about what's happening. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And remember, verse 34, all of the things he's talking about said would happen to that generation. So, the sign of the Son of Man appearing in heaven happened in the first century. And he says, all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. In what way did he come? He didn't come physically. He still hasn't came. So how did he come? Well, he came in judgment. That's how he came. He came in judgment. Go back to the book of Isaiah, book of Ezekiel, and it talks about many times how God comes in judgment when he sends some nation, like Assyria or Babylon, to teach his people a lesson. And of course, that's what's happening here. When the people see the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, they will know that the Son of Man was truly the Son of God, because he's the one that was behind it. The Son of Man is going to be the one that is behind the destruction of Jerusalem. And he was. And it was because the Jews rejected Christ. And so he comes in judgment. And the sign that he came was that he destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Personally, no. But he did it through the Roman army, and in particular, the Prince Titus. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Remember what happened in verse 28. The carcass was dead in AD 70. The Jewish religion was dead. There is really no Jewish religion today like there was up to AD 70. No temple, no altars, none of those sacrifices, none of that. The carcass, it was a carcass and it was dead. What happened as a result of the Jewish religion dying? There was a great harvest of Christians, wasn't there? After AD 70. A great harvest of Christians. That stumbling block or that wall that was keeping a lot of people from becoming a Christians was now gone. Jewish religion, it was dead. The city of Jerusalem was gone. The temple was gone. And so what was keeping a lot of people from obeying the gospel was gone. And so as a result, we see this great harvest, gathering of the elect from all over the world. As a result, remember what happened very similarly in Acts chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, where we see the Christians in Jerusalem, they had been persecuted, and what happened? They were scattered everywhere, and what did they do? Preach the gospel. And what happened as they preached the gospel? There was a great harvest of Christians. So a similar thing happened after the destruction of Jerusalem. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. He gave them all of what they needed to know to be saved. All that they needed to know to be spared from the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Jesus was doing it. So Jesus knew when all these things were going to take place because it was Him coming in judgment upon the Jewish nation and the Jewish people. He was doing it. So He knew when it was going to happen. And so He gave His followers the signs, what would happen. He says, when you see this happen, you know the end is now. And He told them what to do. And as a result, they were saved. Jewish people weren't, because the Jewish people didn't believe Jesus. A million or more were killed. The Christians weren't. And it was all because they had faith in Jesus and what He had prophesied almost 40 years prior to what happened in AD 70. And again, verse 34 and 35, and we'll end. It says, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. And I would put it to you, anybody 10-year-old and older can understand that verse. All these things will come to pass while that generation was there. Not 2,000 years after that, but when that generation was living, all of those things would take place. And Jesus says, kind of as an emphasis to end this first section, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. Jesus says, what I am speaking to you will happen. Temple will be destroyed. Gentiles will come into the city. The Jewish people will be killed. City of Jerusalem will be destroyed. He says, that will take place and there won't be anything that will change it. They had rejected Jesus. He knew He was going to have to die on the cross. And He knew that it was because the Jews rejecting Him as the Son of God. And so that was written for those people, those followers in the first century. Are there signs today? No. We'll have to wait till Wednesday night about that. Jesus was giving His followers, His disciples, a clue about what was going to happen. He had delivered the parables, the wicked vine dresser, the wedding feast, saying that the Jewish nation was going to be destroyed. And then He said why they were going to be destroyed. And He denounced them. And then when His disciples looked at the temple and said, look at this magnificent building and what it represents. Jesus says, that building is going to be destroyed. It's going to be knocked down, one stone upon another. They had a hard time believing what he was talking about. But he gave them those signs because he wanted them to be saved. And if they listened to what he said, they obeyed what he said, they would be saved. And in a very similar sense, that's true today for us. Jesus wants us to be saved. He wants us to be saved. And so he has told us very plainly how to be saved. If we want to be forever with him, we know how to do it. We know that we have to have belief. Just like the people in the first century had to believe what Jesus was saying to be saved, so do we. But belief wasn't all that was necessary. That belief had to have an action attached to it. They had to act on what Jesus said, so do we. We have to repent. Maybe the toughest act of all. Turning away from our sins and turning to Jesus as Lord. Confessing Him before men and then going into the waters of baptism to be saved. That's how we act on our faith. And only when that faith acts does the faith save. And we can be saved tonight in that same way. And if there's anybody that needs to respond, we encourage you to do so as we stand and sing this song.